Hi, Christine. Thank you for joining us. I would love it if we could start with you giving our audience a little bit of background about yourself, maybe where and how you grew up, why you decided to study psychology, and how specifically you came to be interested in this topic.
I love it. It's so interesting. I've never been asked about where and how I grew up. That's a new dimension to this. I grew up in Waterloo. That's about an hour or so outside of Toronto, in Canada. And I grew up with two parents that were incredibly hardworking. My mom is from Lebanon, and she came over at a young age. And my dad was born in Canada. But he's an engineer, and my mom was into computer science, and they were both incredibly hard workers, and they put us in just about every single sport imaginable. Anything that we wanted to do to compete or anything like that, they would throw us into it. So it was good upbringing. And I guess I, around my teenage years, just kind of my transfer from high school into university, I was really competitive in basketball. And I was also a very high achieving student. And I got sick during that time for about 2 years, where I was out of school for a long while. And I also ended up tearing my ACL a couple times and rupturing my Achilles when I was playing basketball. So a lot of my scholarships, academic and athletic wise, and the places that I was being recruited to were threatened. And during that time, I also wound up in a relationship with somebody who was a legitimate psychopath, not the kind that you just say that, not the kind that you just say that it's like, oh yeah, yeah, my boyfriend was a total psychopath. My ex was like crazy. It's like, no, there was the kind of damage and situations that I wound up with him in that the kind of pain that he inflicted and the things that he did out of callousness and intentional maliciousness were, it was a true psychopath. So it took me a while to recover from that. And in my second year of university, I took a class with Dr. Peterson. It was his personality class, I believe, and his approach to psychology, that he wasn't just talking about the history and talking about terminology and talking about biases just as like these interesting facts, but rather he was connecting them in a way to the individual's story and the way how you live in the world and the decisions that you make, there was things that he said that resonated with me that helped sort of, was one of the pieces that kind of helped me pick myself up out of the muck, I guess, that had happened with the past. And that definitely caused psychology to stick with me. And that ended up being what I pursued. After that, I ended up working with Dr. Peterson for over a decade, working with teenagers on a goal setting future authoring program over in Europe, as well as in North America, and helping them, you know, use tools like narrative writing and goal setting to help them make decisions and determine their path in the world. But along this time, I also became his graduate student, and I started my research on political correctness and political belief, which seems like a bit of a tangent. And it's interesting, in our discussion before, you were wondering about the context of it, that perhaps I was being affected in the universities by political correctness. I wish I could say that that was that I was doing this out of some morally virtuous place where I was really standing for something at the time. I believe that Dr. Peterson, the administration, and certain regulations that were being enforced for his clinical practice and things like that was making it very salient for him. For me, it ended up just being a kind of curiosity where when I heard about individuals identifying as being animals and things like that, I was like, wait a second, what? Like, that doesn't seem real. So that's where it came from. But as I got into the research and as the results started to come about, it became relevant to me in a way that was completely different. And it was the way in which these sort of regimes come about that cause such damage, where you see like authoritarian dictatorial regimes that are governed by or that are led by psychopaths or narcissists that are at their core, that really drive them, that take human instincts and then warp them in some way. And that if you look at the percentages of the population, that it's only a couple percent that actually have these pathological traits. So it's not them in and of themselves that are creating these problems, that there's something else that's going on here. There's people surrounding them that are somehow getting locked into this mechanism, and it's causing such severe problems in the world. And that was something that I personally experienced in my relationship. And that led to like mental sort of warping for a few years. So I wanted to understand more about that, to not just frame it as this person's a victim of a psychopath, because that's not helpful. Because how do you, that it's not just the case that they've fallen into their trap. There's something else that's going on there. So anyway, that's my long-winded background.
No, that's all very interesting. Well, it seems like your work, the departure point in part is this premise that left-wing authoritarianism has been, as you say, difficult to conceptualize as a psychological construct. There's plenty of literature on the psychopathy of conservatism and right-wing authoritarianism, but historically less so for liberal and left-wing equivalents. So I guess I'd want to ask, why is that? And how has that shaped how researchers have approached the topic?
Absolutely.
How has it shaped the research field?
Yeah. So just because of the nature of research and the types of individuals that are attracted to that kind of complexity, that the attraction to playing around with ideas, to playing with discourse, that type of thing, that is a trait of openness in personality psychology. We call it openness. That's one of the five factors. And because that's what the nature of research is, that means that individuals that find that naturally, that comes naturally to them, they're more likely to gravitate towards research and towards, looking at these types of dynamics out in the world. But the things that they would then be interested in understanding, in the same way that I was curious about people that identify as animals, and I was like, wait a second, what's going on there? They're doing the same thing with conservatives, where they see the way that conservatives are acting, and they're like, hold on, why are you framing it that way? You can't honestly believe that. So they just are attending to that information with a high level of detail and analyzing it and trying to understand it. But the part of the problem also comes where when we're trying to understand things that aren't like us, we tend to attribute our own motivations and conceptual frame onto those actions. So one of the funniest ones that I always find is their attribution of dominance on the right. So there's one of the factors of political belief and right-wing belief that a colleague of mine discovered, and that's something like masculine independence is what she labeled that factor. And the greatest extension of that is social dominance orientation. So in its pathological form, it becomes social dominance orientation, but this kind of desire for competition, a use of the environment as tools in order to gain strength, that kind of motivation, that competitive sort of fire that comes, that is a piece of conservatism. But liberals will interpret all behavior that is on that dimension as being based out of fear that other people will be taking over their spot of power, that it is like a fear-based motivation, a defensive sort of motivation of their territory, when it's like, nah, I just find it real fun to like be better than you. Like I want you to be strong. Like, are you kidding? So it's just, that's what happens when we try, if we don't possess that same sort of internal motivation, we'll interpret other actions from our own motivational frame. And all of these like contributing factors, the fact that they hyper attend to the one side because it's different than them, and then they try to attribute their own understanding onto it, it just led to a strong bias in the research. And then once you get that bias, people start assuming that that the other side doesn't exist, or like that you are right and that the other. So if you see bad on the one side, you're like, well, because we haven't found bad on the other side, then it must not exist, and that it's only on this side. And yeah.
I mean, as we were saying before, it just seems like this work was very prescient because it was in 2015 that you completed your thesis. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's well before, you know, the catastrophe of the last several years. And this idea that now seems so salient that left-wing authoritarianism can indeed exist in, you know, contemporary America. So anyway, why don't we get into the work itself, into your research, if you could tell us about your hypothesis and then about how you conducted the research and maybe, you know, for those of us who are not familiar, why you did it that way, why this is how you measure these concepts and why that approach is the right one.
Okay. Make sure to wrangle me if I have forgotten one of those pieces.
Sure.
thank you. So the first part was how I constructed the hypothesis or what it was and why it was gone about that way.
Why you approached the research in the way that you did. So the mm-hmm. hypothesis, the research, and then the results, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. So research up until the point when I did my study, there was bits and pieces that were on political correctness. But for the most part, the research just assumed that it existed. They weren't analyzing what exactly made it up, if it was even something that hung together, if the ideas, the policies that people supported, the things that were popularly said that were lumped together as being political correctness, that right-wing believers would be like, oh, you're just being politically correct, or that that were so important in popular belief. It was never analyzed whether those things hung together. And what I mean by that is that people who would support one piece of those things, who would say that, using the words like human as opposed to gendered stuff, or not even human, it would be because that contains the word man in it, that like people who care about that kind of language, that they would also care about things like affirmative action or policies about sexual abuse or sexual harassment, things like that. So that you want to see that support for all the issues, that people who support them tend to support all of them together, and that they're not just supported by different people for different reasons.
So you like, is PC a thing? What is it?
Exactly. Yeah. So research before that hadn't come from that position. It was just saying, well, PC is this one set of these few policies that I've decided are important, and now I'm going to measure the effects of it. Mm. So we wanted to see if it even exists, if it's just something that right-wing people are using to completely discredit all policies of the left, to just lump policies that they're suggesting that are for the environment or for equality or little things that they're doing, that we're just lumping them all underneath the umbrella of communism and saying that this is communist behavior, it's evil, therefore we don't need to listen to any of it, we're just moving on with what we're doing. We wanted to see if it was just that, or also on the other side, them saying that the left-wing people who have more left-wing beliefs saying that this is something that's all coming from good intent, that every single action, all the policies that we're suggesting, it's all based on good intent. It's all based on leveling the playing field, not harming these historically disadvantaged groups, that this is all good. So we wanted to figure out what it was, if it existed. So based on that, the way how we went about it is that we sampled, we took a look at all the literature, newspapers, different reviews, historical texts about the history of political correctness coming all the way from the 1890s in Russia and how it traveled to China, into the movements, into the universities against Vietnam, the women's movement, and then finally onto university campuses and general sort of identity politics. We looked into all of that. We pulled the policies, the things that they cared about, the words that they were playing around with, and created, I think it was like a 250 or 300 item questionnaire. It was enormous. I really feel sorry for people who had to do it. But it included an entire range of things, all the different pieces that biological differences, whether that was an example of of systemic racism or issues like that. Yes, affirmative action. In a later version, we were looking at things like safe spaces, trigger warnings, all those popular sort of terms. And we wanted, and then we also tested personality, intelligence, and disgust sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I need to, if you'd like me to extrapolate on that stuff, but
maybe further along, we could do that when we start to look at the results and what you found.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. So we looked at all that. What we wanted to see first is if it hung together. And I already explained that. To do that, you do something that's called factor analysis, exploratory factor analysis. And basically, you're trying to see, first of all, if all the items hang together in some meaningful way. And then mm-hmm. after that, you're trying to see if they have different pieces to them that are kind of varying. If those people that are responding to certain items tend to respond to a clump of them more in the same way, and that there's another clump of things that are being responded to in a slightly different way, but those are hanging together. And then that's how you kind of get factors out of it. So if things hung together, that meant that it existed in some kind of way. It's sort of like if you were to think about atoms out in the universe, and if they're just kind of floating around randomly, then you mm-hmm. don't really have an object. But then if they're sticking together in some meaningful way that is persisting across time and space, then you have like a chair or some right. other object. So that's kind of what we felt, or what it means when they hang together and it being real, that it was an object or it's something that's kind of real in the social space. And after that, we wanted to determine how it related with other meaningful constructs that have been proven in the past to determine what was behind these different ideas, what was the motivation for them, so that we don't fall into this trap of assuming that just our way of understanding it is 100% the right way, that these ideas are all coming from the same motivational sphere and personality. So that's how we went about it. I guess now I could tell you a bit about the results. So we ended up finding that A, it did exist. B, there's two pieces to it. Mm-hmm. One of the pieces was called PC liberalism. And the other one we called PC authoritarianism. And the core of these two pieces was compassion and this kind of general sort of sensitivity to offense or general sensitivity to like the social sphere. That was the core of political correctness. And that this desire for egalitarianism or equity, that it was then used for different ends. The PC liberalism side, that it was used for, you're trying to achieve equality to level the playing field in order to achieve greater diversity. Whereas mm-hmm. for the authoritarianism side of things, it was that you are trying to level the playing field in order to increase your sense of, increase your space of stability. Of unity is a way of saying it, but I think that it's better understood as a sense of personal stability, that was the two pieces.
How does the PC authoritarianism relate to right-wing authoritarianism? Like, how does it compare and contrast?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so fun. It's a really interesting thing. So I know that I'm going to differentiate between the literature, or between my study and then what mm-hmm. was replicated afterwards, because following this study on political correctness, this was kind of the first sort of hint at least my understanding at ooh, this might be what left-wing authoritarianism looks like. And then mm-hmm. after that, there was some excellent researchers who then took that and they replicated the study using the PC scales. And then they also, there was other researchers that created general left-wing authoritarianism scales and tested those against different personality constructs and things. So I'm going to kind of loop all those in together. Right-wing authoritarianism and left-wing authoritarianism, it appears like they overlap on the dimension that is related to the censorship and authoritarian submission, I would say, which is the appeal to an external authority, a desire for rules that the authority be listened to, and that any dissenting sort of views are dangerous, that they must be censored, that views that are seen as false information or lies or things that it's dangerous because the population is naive and they cannot be trusted. And because of that, that we have to get rid of all that type of information in order to only have the right information there. And this underlying motivation for this is a lack of trust. That seems to be what the overlap is between the right and left wing. In our study on political correctness, was linked to disgust sensitivity. And in research in the past that has been linked to disgust sensitivity, it needs to be replicated, that piece, because the studies that came afterwards on left-wing authoritarianism more generally didn't employ a disgust sensitivity scale. But usually the trust piece and disgust sensitivity are linked. And basically it's that you recognize that the population is capable of sin. You recognize that they are going to be selfish and motivated by their own desires, that they're not always going to take into consideration your needs. And because of that sort of lack of trust of the world, you require an external legal system, an external set of rules, an appeal to authority in order to ensure that we don't devolve into a state where it's just strength battling against strength. That's the contextually relevant kind of way that this sort of personality will come about that makes it understandable. But then the thing about these types of personalities is that they're like applying a hammer to every single solution, where they're just always saying that this is the solution. So that's the core. It's this lack of trust. It is a cognitive rigidity that comes from low openness as well, a sense that there's right and wrong, and that what you know is correct, that anything you don't understand is just inherently incorrect. It's a lack of nuance in the understanding as well, a lack of desire to kind of grapple with things that seem complicated, and that if it's complicated, it's like, that's just not real. So that's kind of the core of the right-wing authoritarianism and left-wing authoritarianism. The way that they differentiate is based on their identification with different pieces of the hierarchy, where left-wing authoritarians, they're higher in compassion, so they will identify with vulnerability. And it's not just in terms of like a desire to protect the vulnerable, but it is also that they are sensitive to the ways that they are demonstrated to be vulnerable in a social environment. So in contrast to strength, in contrast to competition, that highlights your own vulnerability, and they are hyper aware of that. It leads them to this kind of protectiveness and identification with vulnerability. And then on top of that, their compassion likely makes it so that they are more inclusive. They won't just outright sort of want to kill off everything that's unlike them, but instead they'll say, oh yeah, sure, come in, but you must be 100% like us at all times.
Assimilation as opposed to rejection. So maybe this can help explain some of the censorship trends that we've been seeing. Potentially.
Yeah, 100%. Whereas the right-wing authoritarians, they're low in compassion. So they identify with the top of the hierarchy with strength, which leads to the ideas of feeling more superior for individuals that they see as superior within a social environment and dominant within a social environment, that they will identify with them and with the things that those individuals see as being right. And they will adopt that philosophy without question and with complete trust, and then apply that to circumstances beneath them and to the people beneath them. And they're more exclusive in that way, where people that are not following these rules, that are weaker, that they are stomped out. So that's the difference between right and left-wing authoritarianism. The other piece that I wanted to say is the politeness piece. And that was found in research following mine that was when it was replicated. And this is interesting about left-wing authoritarianism because it shows, it explains the part that we see in the environment of them being brawlers. The piece on right-wing authoritarianism that is the brawlers are the social dominance, individuals that are more oriented towards social dominance. So that's that masculine independence piece I was talking about before that in its extreme form goes to social dominance. They're individuals like that, as well as individuals that are high in left-wing authoritarianism are low in politeness. And politeness basically means that you, when you're low in it, it means that you're okay. You perceive yourself to be better than others. You're okay with putting people in uncomfortable positions. You enjoy arguments. That's kind of the instinct underlying it. But what this produces is the anti-hierarchical aggression that you see on the left, where they get enjoyment out of those fights. We also see with left-wing authoritarianism versus right-wing that there's something that's called partisan schadenfreude, which is enjoyment over the pain of those that disagree with you and that are perceived as enemies. And on the right, for socially dominant individuals, that's perceived for individuals that are people who are weak. So the sick, it's also the piece of the right-wing stuff that's linked with race, with true racism and sexism and things like that, is for individuals who identify with their group that's dominant and that those that are weaker should be eradicated.
So I'd love to get in deeper. You mentioned, you know, in these distinctions that PC authoritarians are higher in compassion. And you, in your work, you go into where compassion goes wrong, where it's escalated to the point of pathology. So if you could bring us into that, like the so-called dark side of compassion, and then we can maybe relate that to real world examples or talk about current events.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. So this is relevant a lot to the PC liberal side of things, but because they do overlap in compassion, it's relevant to both. So compassion evolved, it seems, from the mother-child pair bond, that it is a caring emotion that helps helps motivate altruistic behavior, self-sacrifice, that type of thing, giving to those who are in need in order to, you know, help to level the playing field, but pull people out of ruts when life truly has punched them in the gut, as it happens, where people get sick, loved ones die, you know, crazy things come, lightning bolts strike, and compassion is there to sort of help with that for adults, but then also for children to protect them against the same types of things, just so that they have a chance to grow or to recover after illness. So that's where compassion comes from. It, as with all personality traits, personality is like a heuristic. It is a way. The world is incredibly complex. There is so much information there. We need a way of figuring out what to pay attention to, how to understand what we're paying attention to, and then based on that understanding, what are the most relevant actions to come forward, or good actions or potentials of actions that to prioritize that will potentially bring about a good outcome for us and for life in general. So personality is a heuristic process. The different traits frame the world in different way and make us attend to different pieces of information and also prioritize different things and make things more rewarding for people depending on how their personality slants. Compassion specifically pays attention to cues of vulnerability, whether that is you know, expressions of sadness or fear, but also narrative elements that people have where they're actually saying those things. So like, you know, I've lost a lot of money, or I just lost my job and I'm really afraid. I don't know what I'm going to do next. That is a narrative that appeals to compassion and a desire to help. So compassion cues you into these these stimuli that indicate vulnerability. But after that, because you're also attending to those elements in the environment, there's two things that happen there. One is that there's just one study that I'm just trying to remember right now. It's one that's related to compassion specifically. And what they did was they used stimuli that increased a person's level of compassion or that kind of prompted compassion from them. Mm. And then based on that, they determined the level that a person feels like, how close they feel or how much they feel that they identify with or how similar they are to different groups in the environment. And they had a separate group, population of people to rate the degree to which these different groups are deemed disadvantaged or vulnerable populations. And what they found was compassion not only increased the likelihood that you will feel like you are similar to other groups in general. So I feel like there's a piece of me, I can relate to many different people around the world in all different circumstances, but also that the ones that I am more likely to feel like I am similar to are actually the ones that are vulnerable groups. So mm-hmm. that was the first kind of study that showed that there is something about compassion that makes you not only attend to these stimuli more deeply and pay attention to them, but then to also identify with groups that are portraying those types of characteristics. And pride works in the opposite direction, where pride will actually make you identify more with groups that are that are strong or that are socially deemed strong. So it not only does that, but then the other piece of compassion. So you prioritize certain stimuli more, you identify with groups of vulnerability more, but then you also are likely to aggress against individuals that will compete with those that are the group that you have prioritized. And that's because identification with something works in the same way that other research has shown for group identification. Once you identify with your group, you're more likely to process that information more deeply. You're more likely to attribute good motivations to your group and bad motivations to everybody else. The things that your group achieves that are good are because of inherent qualities about them, whereas the things that they do that are bad are because of contextual factors and it wasn't their fault. So you get those basic group dynamics, but there's another study that was really interesting that is, you will actually punish out-group members even when they're not aggressing. And this is the impact of compassion as well, where you'll get two narratives. So you're put into this study and you're told that you are in control of causing one of these two individuals who you can't see that they must take like a shot of hot sauce or something like that. And it's set up that they're going to be competing against each other. And it's explained to you that in this competition, the act of having some hot sauce is going to wreck their performance in some way and make it less likely that they'll get the financial reward at the end. So you're then given these two narratives of, or this narrative of these people. And one of the narratives, the testing condition was, again, this person, they're in financial need, like they just lost their job or something like that. And one of the narratives will say like, but I'm going to be okay. Like, I'm confident that good things are going to come. No worries. The other narrative will say, I'm really afraid about this. I don't know what I'm going to do next. And that's the one that was indicating vulnerability that was meant to trigger compassion. When you give somebody that narrative, they are more likely to send hot sauce to the other person in just to make it so that that person can preferentially win. But the meaning of that action is punishment of the other group. So that's it. So that's the impact. I would say the direct impact of compassion is that it causes the prioritization of facts, the constant understanding of cues of vulnerability, where you're not going to approach them from a position of skepticism. You're not going to question where it's coming from. You're not going to attribute any agency to the individual who is displaying that vulnerability. And instead, you're going to look to the context to try and figure out where the problem is. How do I solve that problem so that this person isn't suffering so much? And because of that, you're never going to hold them to account. There's no accountability there on their part. There's no ability to say that something is right or wrong for the individual to treat them as an agent, where you would say if there's right or wrong, and then you end up just with complete blanket forgiveness. So yeah, that's the bias.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because in a way this would almost describe me. You know, I consider myself an empath, you know, very compassionate. I come from the left. But there's a way in which I feel like on a mass scale, this has been weaponized in a very disingenuous way. And, maybe we could talk about that, like how you see this in, you know, unfolding in real time and real world examples. Just those limits of compassion, how compassion becomes pathological and how it's weaponized. Maybe I think other people have done research after you about, you know, dark triad traits and narcissism and different levels, different segments of the population leveraging control over this dynamic and how this is borne out in such a dramatic way over the past several years.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that I want to build a little bit on what I was just talking about and use a personal, an example that I think will be relevant to the listeners that if they are high in compassion, that they'll kind of understand that is on the interpersonal level. So
yeah.
In a relationship, for example, if you are high in compassion, you're going to be paying a lot of attention. And even if you're not high in compassion, if it's somebody that you love and that you care about, if you're in a relationship with somebody where you formed that kind of attachment and that bond with them, you're going to be paying attention to their reactions to your actions. So how the things that, what you do, the impact that it has on them. So anytime that you say something, like for example, honey, you left your fork on the kitchen table again, you didn't put it in the dishwasher, and that they react kind of annoyed to that, and are like, why do you care about that? You're paying attention to that outcome. And if you are higher in compassion, or again, with this pair bond, what your instinct is then to make that reaction understandable, so that you're going to now start arguing from their position or trying to make their personality, their wants, their needs understandable. So you're going to think about what in the context can be changed, which is you. You're the one in the context can be changed in order to not produce that outcome. What can I do in order to make this reaction not happen again? What can I change in order to make this reaction not happen again? But the problem when you do that is that you then build out their personality and their wants and needs, their goals for them. You make it so that the space is incredibly comfortable for them, but you completely knock out your own personality, the piece of you that is different from them, the piece of you that is unique, that would make the relationship more creative if you were to bring it to life. So if you're more orderly, for example, and you do really care about putting dishes in the dishwasher and cleaning up after yourself, but then your partner is a little bit less orderly, you're going to constantly be pissed off about it. Mm-hmm. But what you're going to then do in your head is say, oh, okay, well, the fact that I'm pissed off means I'm not patient enough. The fact that I am pissed off means that, you know, this is just a fork. It's just a fork on the table. Why does that matter? He does all these other really great things for me. He's clearly very loving of me. Like, why do I care so much about the fork? Clearly there's something like wrong, like that I'm just being so irritable about this fork. Why can't I just pick it up and put it in the dishwasher? So these kinds of appeals to gratitude, why can't I do better? All this that you're doing right now is you're framing his actions and his wants and needs as good and yours and the context as evil. So you're doing this to yourself now rather than just in the political sphere of attacking other people, but to yourself. How can I change? How can I do better in order to make this relationship work? But in doing so, you've removed the part of you that is a little bit more orderly, the piece of your personality that is a little bit different, and suddenly you're just completely you're moving in a way that's ideal towards him and not negotiating for yourself as well. So that the act of doing that produces a little narcissist, like you're making your partner more narcissistic because you're not putting a limit on any of that stuff. You're and from a genuine place, not just from a spot of like, oh, I need to train my partner. That's not what you're doing. It's from a genuine spot that that there is something in a loving relationship that is aimed at something that is better than the than both of you, that requires not just movement towards your shared goals, but also each of you holding space for your individual goals that are independent of what you personally understand. So this is the way how compassion ends up playing. And we see the same thing with mothers and children. I'm an assistant coach for basketball and I've coached for many years. And at some of the camps, we'll get mothers that come in that are that see their children as absolute angels and are unwilling to attribute any blame or responsibility and unable to see that their children may be manipulating them. And instead, it's everybody else's fault. And it's the requirements on the environment for the environment to change in order to make things better. And it's the same thing in some of the private school systems that I've worked with as well, where they see this same sort of dynamic. And the product of this permissive style of parenting is narcissism in the children. So when you are unwilling to... So there's the phrase that they use in writing, which is to to sacrifice your darlings. I think
kill your darlings.
Kill your darlings. Yeah. When you're unwilling to kill your darlings, that means that you are willing to sacrifice everything. You're all like part of your personality, part of your virtue, all of that in order to get the thing that you want. And we don't see this as compassion. We don't see that in the way of compassion because you think that compassion is an altruistic, you're giving for somebody else. But the thing that you're not willing to sacrifice there is the bond. You're not willing to risk the relationship. So in that moment, you are unwilling to, we'll go back to the fork example, you're unwilling to start an argument where you might be unreasonable, where you don't have the answers yet, where somebody, you know that the other side could point out the reasons why you wanting the fork gone is, it doesn't make sense. It's not reasonable. It's like, why does it really matter that the fork's on the table? Again, like, don't you see all these good things that I'm doing for you? And it's like, yeah, there's answers to all those things that make what you want in the relationship unreasonable, but that I still need to put this out there and rely on the fact that I care about this for some reason that I don't completely understand. And I need to be willing to sacrifice my perfection, my sense that I'm going to be completely reasonable, that I'm not going to come across as angry, and potentially even sacrifice the relationship itself in order to have something better come about. And to kind of take that leap of faith and to have a sense of trust there, not in your partner necessarily to be reasonable. They may not, they may be really mean, they may be manipulative, but to have a sense of trust that things will work themselves out and that you'll come to see things different. And if you don't do that, what you end up with is a cognitive rigidity that is like an anchor in the environment. Have you ever heard of the 9-dot problem?
No.
Okay, so the 9-dot problem is a problem that they talk about in psychology all the time, and it's used in wisdom research. And basically, there's 9 dots, 3 rows of 3 dots each. Mm-hmm. And often you're presented with solving this problem where they give you then a square around those 9 dots. Mm-hmm. And they tell you that you need to connect all of these 9 dots with only 4 lines, but you cannot remove your pen from the paper when you do so. So when you look at this and you see the square around the dots, you can't solve the problem because you're thinking that you need to stay within the lines. It's like it's a frame that they put there. That's a nice little trick. And even if they don't have the square there, you see the outline of these 9 dots and you're like, oh, well, I have to like draw within those. So you can't solve the problem. And it's not until you actually you do like a breaking frame, but you'll see that you actually have to draw outside the lines. You're gonna have to look this up online for anybody who's listening. You'll have to look it up online to see the solution. Yeah, exactly. But that's the way how it works when we don't, when we're not willing to kill our darlings, sacrifice our attachments, sacrifice the things that we love, or at least being willing to risk them. They act as anchors on our perception in terms of our goals and what we think a good life is made up of. And we will warp ourselves. Again, with the example of a relationship, you will continue to try and make yourself better in the image of your partner's ideal, which is completely ignoring the part of you that is an individual and that is unique, and the part of you that will bring life and give you life as well, that is ongoing. And as you stomp that out more and more, and you are hanging on to these images of what a good marriage is, of what a good relationship is, of what it is to be a good mother, all these things that are like, you see these as specific actions or pieces of the environment, and you're not willing to let those things go to see what actually lies underneath them, that you will kill yourself. You will become very, you'll turn into a person that you don't like. You'll start acting towards people that care about you when they start to question your relationships in a way that is mean, that is defensive. And you'll walk away from those interactions just being like, oh, who am I? You'll become more isolated. And it is like a slow, it's a death by a thousand cuts by not being willing to let those go.
Is this something that you've experienced personally?
Yeah, I mean, that's what happened that's what happened in my relationship. But it's funny, like it's reoccurring. It happens. Mm-hmm. You have your first relationship and you want to find love, and you have those initial moments of lust, and you're like, oh, this is it. Here we go. Let's go. Let's build. And then it's like, then the bad signs start to come in, and you're just like, no, it's good. Don't worry, I got this. And like, so you'll just stick with that. But it also happens with your first job that you get. And you're like, yes, here we go. All right, I've got a career. Let's do this. And then that doesn't work out. And then it's like, okay, now you've got your first like entrepreneurial venture where you put some creative effort into something, and it's taken off, and you're like, oh yeah, this is good. Here we go. Let's go. And then it doesn't work out. And it in those moments when it's not working out, you see, it seems totally unreasonable why things are like, why the plug is being pulled. Like, you can see a path forward. You can make it work if only we just did this and this and this. But it's not until you also start to feel the death of yourself, like daily waking up angry and those types of things, that you're like, I'm dying right now. I need to let this go. And it's just, it will be for no good reason. It will seem completely irrational that you have to let it go, but you have to be willing to forgive those that seem irrational. So whether that is yourself or other people, to forgive them, to forgive yourself in those moments, just being like, yeah. And then to do the thing they call it for like religion, sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, be willing to sacrifice your life in order to see what comes next, and in order to live again.
Okay. Well, first I just want to say that my husband would really love this conversation because I'm the one who leaves the fork out usually. But I did want to ask if we could kind of bring everything that you were just talking about now back to kind of like a, you know, macro social level. Yes. Kind of, and relate it back to PC authoritarianism and PC liberalism.
Absolutely. I love it. Okay. So we know that personality, I've mentioned, are heuristics, and that political belief, that it clusters on two dimensions of personality that like cluster together. So we've got the first dimension, which is kind of like the order traditionalism on the conservative side versus something like freedom and radicalism on the liberal side. And the personality traits that underlie those are openness and orderliness. So we'll see that for liberals, they're high in openness, low in orderliness, whereas conservatives are low in openness and high in orderliness on that dimension. The other dimension is the one that's kind of like competition versus egalitarianism. And that one is differentiated by compassion. So on the liberal side, we get higher compassion. On the conservative side, you see lower compassion. So we have these heuristic processes that are in competition with each other. And that it is through that competition that we are able to explore the unknown and develop solutions, because it's not just that one is inherently correct, but rather through the negotiation of the two that we're able to see all dimensions of the world. That's the philosophy behind it. But they're heuristic processes that kind of rear their heads in the moment of uncertainty. So something happens, a pandemic hits, political leadership is going a little awry, like all these different things that sort of change the dynamics of the world.
A little.
And these personalities rear their heads and they're like, this is the solution, or this is how we understand this situation. This is what's really going on. And this is the way how we need to act in order to right things, to return things to good, or to move things forward. Now, problems arise when these personality traits believe they are inherently correct. And that's that idea, again, that I was talking about of not being willing to kill your darlings, where each of them has their own flavor of this not being willing to kill your darlings. And they end up sticking on them and they get stuck. And then it's in those moments where psychopaths and narcissists see quick ways to the top. They will go into that area because they see a bunch of people. They don't actually see this, but this is what's going on, is that there's a bunch of people that are there that are willing to sacrifice everything to get what they want. That's the like when personality kind of gets stuck in this cognitive rigidity, they're willing to sacrifice absolutely everything to get what they want. And if a narcissist or a psychopath comes in and it's like, oh, I can give you what you want, just do this, this, and this for me. That's like in the interpersonal relationship, but we'll see that in where they'll create environments, for example, of censorship, and being hyper-focused on information that is deemed aggressive or is going to be harmful of other individuals, that they then create these organizations that will deal with that stuff. And the organization, then the individuals within it believe that they are doing good and they are fighting evil, because that's what happens when you really get attached to your personality. You get this sense of justice that you are fighting the good fight. And then a psychopath will come in and be like, oh, okay, this is a very fast way for me to be able to exert control, to climb a hierarchy, to tell other people to do what I want, to gain status. And that, for the more malicious kinds of these dark triad traits, that they are able to punish the people that, you know, they feel has harmed them, or just in general have an opportunity to punish people. That's where then they'll then hop into these movements and really take advantage of the fact that they're surrounded by a bunch of people that are willing to sacrifice everything in order to get what they want. So it's, yeah. I'm wondering if we wanted to talk more about it. I guess I'll leave it up to you, but like if we want to differentiate more about these dark triad traits and how they evolve, or
Definitely. I mean, we don't have to go into this more. We can go wherever you want. It was just interesting to me because when you look at this on the surface, you know, oh, this is about compassion and PC liberals are more compassionate. It's almost counterintuitive if you've paid attention over the last few years, because I don't know, compassion can't seem to explain what's happened. And it seems like something has replaced like genuine compassion as the mechanism. Like, I don't believe that so much of everything that's going on in our world is just a result of liberals feeling compassion and empathy for other people. It's taken on an entirely different dimension. I don't know. That was just a comment, but yeah, we can definitely get into more of these other traits, the dark triad traits, and how you started to talk about how, you know, maybe narcissists and psychopaths will come in and hijack or leverage people who are willing to give up everything to get what they want. But so, people who are willing to give up everything, that's not compassion though, right?
Yeah. So it's the way in which we turn ourselves into the people that we hate. That like the moment that you cross that line where it started off as compassion. That's what created your desire to help. And it was that rewarding sense of being a person who can help people and being the one who can help pull somebody up.
Or like, isn't it all about that though? Doesn't it come down to there is a point at which it becomes more about virtue signaling and your sense of self that's completely built upon these sort of rituals of that look like compassion, you know, that look like empathy, that look like justice. Mm-hmm. But no longer really mean the same thing. And yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love your use of the word rituals. It becomes no longer coming from a spot of genuine understanding or a genuine sort of creativity that's inspired by the environment, but instead you're habitually relying on these actions, but they've now been transposed towards something else, which is your own personal sense of superiority, it's interesting. The sphere of narcissism has, the research on it really exploded following Trump, but I mean, it's been exploding for a while. And one of the most recent dimensions that people started to extrapolate on was this idea of communal narcissism. And it is the altruistic form of narcissism where rather than just going with the sort of traditional competitive version where you'll imagine a narcissist who's climbing a financial hierarchy like on Wall Street or some type of competitive business. And, you know, they're really tough minded and, you know, just saying it how it is and that type of person. But rather, these are individuals that fulfill their grandiose needs by being the best parent or being the person that is going to save the world or being the best listener. And they idealize compassion rather than idealizing intellect and, you know, more traditional sort of masculine dominance. Mm-hmm. So that is an instance where you'll see the acts of compassion, the words, the virtue signaling, that comes from a spot of this communal narcissism. But again, the core of it is this piece of entitlement. And that is kind of the core of all narcissism. It's entitlement and self-importance, where it's not just that you enjoy helping other people. And it's not just that you enjoy being influential, but that you are great at that. And you are also that other people should know that you are great at it. And that if they don't show that, if they don't recognize your greatness, that there is something wrong there. And on the more victim side or vulnerable side of narcissism, it's not just neuroticism, where it would be that you are, if people are angry at you, or if they're bullying, or that you'll interpret cues more as being bullying, or interpret cues of aggression more broadly, that you interpret more words as being aggressive. It's not just that then you'll, because people who are just neurotic, they might react in anger, but afterwards they're going home and they're thinking, man, I am a piece of shit. Like I'm really worthless. I'm not. But that's a neurotic person. But individuals who are vulnerable narcissists hold this piece of entitlement, which is, I am great and I am deserving of greatness and people should notice my greatness. So when they are being bullies, it's like, yeah, and I want to punish you for that because you are wrong. And I will take great joy in seeing your suffering and my pain. The fact that you can't recognize my pain and that you aren't prioritizing that, well, there's something very evil about you. It's this entitlement around the pain and around their suffering that creates the more vulnerable narcissist. So this was all starting with compassion and the fact that there's something that happens there where it gets warped, that it's not just that it starts off with this good intent. Perhaps a piece of it is good intent or is just human reaction to uncertainty. And that would be like on the side that we see the left-wing authoritarians, that desire for protectiveness. Because when you do have more, when you do have situations of tyrannical governments or people that are in power that do have, that do hold power, and what they are doing is they are taking advantage of that power and just running roughshod with it and not taking care of the people beneath them, that the reaction to that is a defensiveness of your boundaries, that it is like, okay, this has to stop. I'm sorry. No. And that is a left-wing authoritarian sort of instinct, that's where that's coming from. So these are human instincts that make sense and are understandable, but they get warped. And that's what, like, where you'll get then altruistic narcissism, where it becomes about yourself. And it becomes about this maintaining this attachment that you have, not being willing to, you know, accept that there's more out there than your own mind, and the things that you find valuable and your own understanding of things. 100%.
Yeah. Can you explain why? Okay, actually, let me go back. Because first of all, I have a question, you know, just about the language. In 2015, you set out to investigate and perform kind of a metric analysis of PC, of political correctness. Now we have different terminology. Does it map? Does PC map cleanly onto wokeness, wokeism? Is there any, are there distinctions? Is there an expansion? That would be the first part, I guess. And then, that's okay. Let's start with that because I can't remember the second part.
No worries. Although unfortunately, I think it might be a short answer. I mean, okay. As with anything, I would say, like, coming from a researcher's mind, it's like, I don't want to say 100% for certain until I've tested it. You'd have to test it to make sure. But my hunch is that, it's all around the same things, because these political voices, the underlying instincts beneath them, the personalities, they don't change. They just change the contents of the stuff that they care about changes. But it all, the personalities stay the same and the dimensions kind of stay the same.
So why are we seeing so much more? Why is the scale so different?
The stuff, it goes in waves. It really does. I think it goes in waves. And I also think that it depends on the area of the world that you're surrounded by. There's a large chunk of the world that thinks that with Dr. Peterson's sort of rise to fame and his, putting a voice to certain ideas, that has provided this sort of countervailing sort of force against this. And because of it, there's still like rebellion on both sides, but it is kind of like working itself out at this higher level of consciousness. And it's not like you can't eradicate this stuff. And to believe that it should be eradicated is like actually it's not a good spot to come from. I think that the fact that wokeism still exists is like totally, it makes sense. And it's like, it's fine as long as like, we're not just trying to stomp out those voices. Cause then you get the same thing as what they're saying on the right, where like, you know, you don't want that stuff going behind doors.
Is there more neuroticism? Are there more mood disorders? Did everybody collectively lose their mind?
So this is really funny part. It's so funny you bring up neuroticism. And I find this really interesting, is that when this research was being done, neuroticism was not a predictor of offense, of the sensitivity to offense. It was not a predictor of this caring about politically correct language, about wokeism. And I found that so interesting, because when you look at Haidt's work on, not helicopter parenting, but he had a word that he had for the generation of people that were kind of like just reeds that are just, so flimsy and not resilient. And I forget what word he used, but when you describe them in that way, you think of somebody that is very neurotic. And the interesting part about this movement is that it's not a neurotic movement, that it is one that is coming from a hypersensitivity, which is different. And whether that is from a disgust sensitivity, where you're very sensitive to sort of chaos in the world and to that type of thing, or if it's coming from a sensitivity to interpretation of being hyper aware of social cues and cues that you're interpreting as aggressive. There's a link there to potentially, there's been a link in research between compassion and oxytocin. And it's tough to sort of draw a direct line between the two, but the researchers have played around with this idea that there's something about oxytocin that might be linked with compassion, or at least with that mother-child pair bond. They're more sure of that. And the thing about oxytocin is that it is not just a love drug. It does not just make you caring of everything, but rather it makes you hyper aware of social cues. And whether that is, for some people, that makes them hyper aware of competitive social cues, of the dynamics of competition. And for other people, it makes them hyper aware of the set of the cues of relations, like relationships and more communal sort of aspects to it. So the sensitivity is surrounding a hyper awareness of the social environment, but it's not neurotic, which is interesting. The research I did find in my own personal research that there was a link to having a family member who had depression or anxiety, or even you yourself having depression or anxiety, but it wasn't linked to neuroticism. So yeah.
All right. Well, we'll keep looking for the easy explanation.
that one thing that will explain it all. Don't you get into that mental bias, just trying to figure out why we're right.
you did also look at, I thought these correlations were interesting with regard to left-wing authoritarianism. So you mentioned sensitivity to interpersonal disgust, orderliness, were strong predictors, but also limited vocabulary. Can you about that?
Yeah. That's actually something that's found across authoritarianism in general. And that sort of links into that piece of their cognitive rigidity that you see, where the problem with having a limited vocabulary, so much of our world and so much of navigating social relationships is being able to put into words the things that you care about and the things that you value. And a piece of that comes from sort of like an assertiveness, an ability to assert those values, but it's also being able to joust with somebody and to change, to add new words and new images and new symbols and things like that to make what you're saying and make what you're thinking comprehensible to somebody else. You have to be flexible in your use of language and your ability to pull words together in order to bridge that gap between you and somebody else. Now, if you have a more limited vocabulary and you're not able to be so flexible with your words, that causes a lot of problems out in the world. You can't, it makes it much harder for you to come to a positive sort of way for two people to sort of understand themselves understand each other when they disagree, to come to some sort of compromise. And instead you're sort of put in this position where it's like, yeah, but this is just what I want. And you can't bridge that gap as easily. It makes it much harder, or at least it makes social environments more threatening, or circumstances where you're likely to run into disagreement, either more threatening, or then you have to fall in love with the act of disagreeing and the act of just having a fight with somebody, but it's not coming to an understanding between you two, and it's just a fight. So that it makes it easier for them to want to rely on an external authority, on an external sense of justice, on an external set of rules to bring about the things that they care about and to ensure that people act in a way that they believe to be good and right, so that they don't have to engage in those disagreements and conversations and compromises themselves, because it's just harder. That's the piece that is the lower vocabulary. Yeah.
That's very interesting. I'm sure you've read that paper. I don't know if you want to discuss it or not, but in which they talk about, I mean, this kind of builds on the narcissism research and all of this, I think, to an extent, but where they talk about virtuous victim signaling.
Oh yeah, the one that you sent over. Yeah.
Yeah. As a method, a strategy for resource extraction. I think that's so interesting. And to me, it just answers some of the, you know, the suspicion and the cynicism. It's like, that would make a lot of sense to me. That would explain a lot. But what do you think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that That study was interesting to me for a couple reasons. One is that, again, it highlighted this fact that there is a bias that comes with compassion, and it is the desire to justify that or to completely trust individuals who are giving these victim signals, and that the act of questioning somebody who is in that position is evil, or that it is just coming from a patriarchal sort of position of like masculine dominance, and that you cannot question victims, that it's wrong to do that. That it is so important to know that evil exists everywhere in every corner. It's not like you, like the one thing that you're doing is like that it's not possible for somebody to come up in that sphere and be manipulative. That people that are giving these narratives forward, that it's important to recognize that it is possible that somebody is doing this with bad intent, that people are expressing things with bad intent, that they're not coming at things honestly, and instead that it's coming from a spot of callousness and intentional malice, or at least that they are doing things or continuing to act in a way without remorse. So that situations where profit can be gained quickly without any real work, that or with minimal real work, that there are people that will flock into those spots and use them. So this study that was on the victim narratives, that was a scale that was basically, it was pointing to contextual cues or the amount of times that you will point to circumstances or tell your friends that something is circumstantially caused. I think it was different instances of that. This questionnaire that individuals who demonstrate those types of narratives, that they are more likely to have, it wasn't correlated with all the dark triad traits. And I think that it was unfortunate that they did not measure vulnerable narcissism. The measure that they used in that one was grandiose narcissism, which those types of narcissists are individuals that really value their strength and how strong and great they are. So they would be, just because it would run totally counter to that narrative that they're trying to build for themselves, to say that I am weak and that there's something that other people or the environment was somehow able to take advantage of me, or that that I wasn't perfect and that I didn't have everything already figured out. And then in some way, something bad happened that was outside of my control. That just runs completely counter to them. So I think that's the reason why I believe it was only Machiavellianism that popped out as being a strong correlation. But I believe that if they were to have measured the correlation with vulnerable narcissism, that they probably would have seen that it would be a strong predictor of it, just because the vulnerable narcissists appear to be the type that are more likely to adopt these victim narratives and to mobilize them in order to gain profit. And that was the first half of this study, was basically just showing that, yes, demonstrating a victim narrative, one where it says that you have been the cause of unfair circumstances, or that your suffering has been caused by unfair circumstances in the environment, that something bad has happened to you that was outside of your control, that people will give money for that cause and expect nothing in return. And right there, you are creating an environment that is just like ripe for harvesting for somebody else to be like, oh, I can take advantage of that situation and to gain profit.
It's such an interesting dynamic. And I love that you pointed out that, you know, they might have been able to even prove their thesis more if they would have included, you know, if they would have analyzed a different, not just grandiose, but vulnerable narcissism. But I think it's so interesting because that dynamic just seems to be part of our culture now, you know, at such a mass scale.
What dynamic do you mean?
Using virtuous victim signaling as a strategy for resource extraction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that again, it's this idea where people come to things honestly in the initial fluctuation of the world, where it's just, you know, there's honestly people who have been harmed by circumstances. But once attention starts to be given to a certain area and a certain cause and a certain problem that's happened or a certain catastrophe, that then, and it's, then it becomes obvious as well that reward and positive emotion and all these other things, and that you've lifted people up in status in some way. Once these things have happened naturally and we start to see the results of certain actions, that's when more agentic people that are these narcissists and psychopaths that are just out for their own personal gain, that they then pay attention to those outcomes and they're like, okay, so if I just, you know, do those same things, I can get that good outcome. All right, I'll do that.
It's a golden age for grifters. I mean,
there you go.
It really is. It's, I hope people are really enjoying this run while it lasts. But yeah, you know, because you point out too that extreme compassion leads to overly trusting behavior and inability to differentiate right and wrong. So all of that just fits together so nicely, doesn't it?
It's the perfect storm when these things come together. It really is.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer. I would just maybe ask your thoughts on where the research can or should go from here, like what you would to see happen.
Well, I mean, just the first thing that comes to mind is I think that, I mean, so there was the one study that came out that was cited in the article on these censorship bodies. And it was the one that was linking left-wing authoritarianism to pathology. And specifically, it found that it was linked with psychopathy. In the first study, it found that it was linked with, what was it? It was the more rivalrous narcissism. And that is the one of resentment and, true malice, desire to see harm to others, envy, all those kinds of emotions. That piece of narcissism. But then in the second study, they found that it was correlated with psychopathy and the narcissism sort of, they used a different measure for narcissism and that relationship disappeared. But that's again, because they used a measure of narcissism that was linked, that was the grandiose type, which is more the extroversion piece of it. So in that study, in the first piece of it, they found that narcissism, that it was linked with, vulnerable narcissism that we saw, and specifically the censorship piece, the desire to censor was linked with vulnerable narcissism. But then they used another measure that they included in their regression, which was all the things that predict something else. So whether being narcissistic will predict your proclivity to want to censor things. They included another measure in that, which is socially desirable responding. And once they included that, it eliminated the relationship between vulnerable narcissism and censorship. And the reason I believe, or I'd be curious to find out, I think that the reason why that was is because there's something that's called a moderating relationship between those. And socially desirable response, or individuals who are high in vulnerable narcissism, there's a significant negative relationship between that and socially desirable responding. So what that means is they will absolutely not care even more to anybody else that you know that they lie. They will report that they lie, that they cheat, that they don't pick up after themselves. Like, they really do not care that you, like, they see that stuff as great. That is like, it is part of the, so it's a power thing. It's a, yeah, like, I really don't care. And, but it's a significant negative correlation. And it's only with that part of narcissism. With the other parts of narcissism, they actually don't care about how, like, there's no significant relationship between them and socially desirable responding. They also, like, they value their aggression. They don't care that you perceive them as being good people, but it's not like that they don't care that you perceive them as being good people. It's that they don't think that people see those acts as being good. They think that people that are the best, that they care about their opinions of, are the ones that see aggression as a form of strength. And that, so anyway, All this to say that I think the reason why the relationship between vulnerable narcissism disappeared was because of this one additional piece that they decided to add, and they didn't test the moderating relationship. I think that fleshing out more what vulnerable narcissism looks like in relation to these political ideas, I think is important. I think that it's the nature of vulnerable narcissism specifically that is kind of producing these effects of authoritarianism that are more related to censorship and punitive behavior on the left.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I hope you'll come back and talk to us more maybe about, you know, future research or that censorship angle in particular. We could do a whole different conversation about that.
I would love that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Christine.
Absolutely.